Hey, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix. I'm your host, Cedric Jungelman. In this episode, I chat with Samson Mao, CEO of Jan3, longtime Bitcoiner, and a key voice in nation-state Bitcoin adoption. We talk about the heated Core versus Knots debate. We dive deep into Core V30's proposed policy changes, like the op return shift, what counts as spam, fee dynamics in SegWit, and how developer culture, funding, and incentives shape Bitcoin's future. We also get into ossification, multiple client implementations, and whether any of this shakes Samson's long-term price conviction. If you want a clear, no BS walk through the current discourse, this conversation is for you. If you want to get in touch with me, it's Cedric at thebitcoinmatrix.com. And if you want to help support the show directly, I've added links for Venmo, PayPal, Bitcoin with Strike, and a P.O. box so you can send a check. This show is user-supported, so I really appreciate anything that you contribute. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Bitcoin OG Samson Mao.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Samson Mao is a longtime Bitcoin advocate and the CEO of Jan3, a Bitcoin infrastructure company. He's known for his work on El Salvador's Bitcoin strategy and promoting nation-state Bitcoin adoption. Samson's background includes video game development. Samson founded Pixelmatic in 2011 to create social games and worked on Company of Heroes and Dawn of War at Relic Entertainment. Samson is the former chief strategy officer at Blockstream, a leading Bitcoin infrastructure provider. Samson Mao, welcome back to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
It's great to be on, Cedric. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been a while. There's so much I want to talk to you about, but we kind of called this emergency session here about like Knots versus Core and to try to get into this, and we'll just brush aside everything else. So, you know, when I think of Core, I think of sort of a client that the most mainstream adoption around running a node is on that sort of client or protocol, you know, that software. Is that an accurate portrayal of Core or what we would think Core would be?
Well, Bitcoin Core is the reference implementation. So there are many other implementations such as Knots and BTCD and others, but definitely Core is the most prevalent and dominant one. And that has some risks in and of itself, because if for some reason the Core development team is compromised at some level, then it's going to be difficult to migrate people off of that because it is the most dominant and trusted implementation. And also it's becoming more apparent during this whole discourse that people are not willing to migrate too, even if there is suspicion of some level of it being compromised. There's like blind loyalty to Bitcoin Core, which is kind of dividing the whole Bitcoin user base or community, whatever you want to call that, into different factions right now.
Yeah, well, there's a lot to, you know, sort of unpack there. But what does it mean to kind of work on Bitcoin Core or be a core contributor? How do you interpret that?
Well, it's a wide range of things, because there are people that work on the software itself, that are working on cryptographic libraries, even people that are contributing to localization or bug fixing, QA testing, code review. They're all kind of batched into people on working on Core or being viewed as developing Core. Even if you're just submitting ideas to the mailing list, I think it's kind of a broad term. You can kind of envelop all of that in the term like Bitcoin developer.
So what does it mean to, you know, if you work at, say, a not-for-profit that hires you, or you've gotten a grant to work on a certain project, or you have worked on Core? I mean, are they all equal to each other? Does, you know, aren't people who are philosophically pontificating on what Core should be also working on Core? You know, like someone who hasn't contributed to Core yet or hasn't had anything codified, it could be working on Core. But they might not get the same voice as someone who's either already contributed or is sort of hired, whether it's permanently or sort of contractually on a short-term basis.
Well, you have all of that in the mix. And I think that's kind of one of the drivers of the issue, which is how do you determine whose opinions are valid? So if you go back in time to the origin of the whole shifting away from Core, it was over OpenTurn. And the fact that they were blocking people or banning them from GitHub because they were saying we're being brigaded. And they blocked Luke at some point, Mechanic at some point. And there's a lot of dismissal about people's feedback. And you know, they're saying we want discussion, but then they don't really want discussion. And it's more like it's already decided. And that kind of brings us down the rabbit hole to another level, which is, you know, are developers working at companies kind of in an echo chamber of their own and sort of pre-deciding what changes are good and what changes should make it in, and then kind of going through the motions of discussing in public? Because there's a lot of weird stuff that happened back then. Like they locked the thread and unlocked it so that someone could hack it, and then locked it again to kind of manufacture consent or agreement. But there was just a lot of stuff like that. And it's never apparent who was responsible for these kind of antics and if anything was done about it. It's just kind of like things happen and nobody's really responsible. And then things continue to happen. So this is why I believe there's sort of a shattering in trust of core developers. And it's understandable that you see a lot of conspiracy theories come up. And it's not really helped either by how a lot of the core developers are behaving. Now, I'm not saying like the not side are angels, but you know, there are people doing and saying bad things on both sides that I think should be de-escalated and toned down because it's not helpful. But definitely, I would say it's instigated on the core developer side when you go back in time and you look at the origin of the whole schism.
All right, so let's maybe try to get to the origin of this. Is this about, right now, let's say this is about OpenTurn, and is that correct? And then maybe what is OpenTurn? What is maybe happening in Core V30 with OpenTurn that is sort of, or that's been coded in and not yet released, is how I understand it. What is that happening there?
So it comes down to removing defaults and removing the ability for people to change the defaults, or at least change them easily. So it's the data carrier and the OpenTurn limit, which is being lifted from 83 bytes to the maximum, which is like 10,000 bytes or something like that. So, you know, it's basically core developers trying to change something, which I think people don't want them to change. And it's led to this whole discussion of should core developers listen to people? Because then it's like, they're capitulating to peer pressure or pressure from external sources. But then on the flip side of that, you have people questioning, like, why are they initiating this change in the first place? And is it because, you know, they were bribed or there's money involved or something like that, or some other perverse incentives? Like, I don't know, they're in league with the people trying to spam the chain. And then you get the whole other rabbit hole of like, is there such thing as spam too, which is another thing.
So yeah, maybe spam is a good place to go here. So we're going to, if the OpenTurn limit is upped, and it seems like it's a significant increase, like a 100x or a 1000x, I've heard the term 1000x here. What does that enable? You brought up like who would want this? Maybe it's not everyone, but how would that be utilized? What are maybe some of the effects of that, you know? And yeah, we could talk about spam, but start wherever you want there.
Well, I mean, it's not sure who would want to use OpenTurn right now. So the issue is that a company called Citrea that's building a layer 2 is using UTXOs and tiny UTXOs to store data instead of OpenTurn, because they're saying the OpenTurn limit is too constraining and they need 160 bytes or something like that. So Bitcoin Core developers kind of are changing default settings to accommodate them, which I think is another issue, because it's what we call in game development, it's a slippery slope. Once you start changing something for a company, then you start changing more things for other companies. So that you can see like both sides of the coin here. The users are saying, don't change it. and people are congratulating the devs for staying the course and changing it. But at the same time, they're changing it because someone else asked for a change too. And there's a video of Antoine Poinsot saying, like, you know, I was talking to this Citria developer and he needed this. And I thought, well, why don't we just change it? And that's what he is saying on camera, not what anyone else is saying. It's not an accusation, but it is a fact. Like, there are changes being done to accommodate external parties, external protocols to Bitcoin itself. And I don't think that's really a good thing. But going back to your main point, who's using it? Nobody's really using it at this point because OpRetern is 4 times more expensive than using data in UTXOs. So it's really not a good argument. And I think a lot of people are seeing through that. Like, yes, in theory, it'd be good if everyone used OpRetern because it can be pruned. But will they use it? And I don't know. I mean, you shouldn't really trust that they're going to change their protocol and use something that's more expensive, right? You should expect people will trend to the cheapest method of doing whatever they're trying to do. But the question it really begets is, should core developers be changing anything for an external party?
Right. So maybe who's Chaincode?
Chaincode is a private company that is funding a lot of Bitcoin development. So it started by Alex Morcos and Suhas, and they're basically funding it with their own money, I believe. And it was formed, I'm not sure, but it was probably around the time of Blockstream. But back in like 2016, 17 is really mainly Blockstream, MIT, and Chaincode that was funding Bitcoin development.
I've come across them before. To me, it's very concerning. I'll read Alex's bio from the Chaincode website. So it's he's the co-founder, one of the early pioneers of automated trading, and co-founded Hudson River Trading in 2002, where he spent 10 years working to make markets more efficient and improve market structure. He discovered his passion for Bitcoin in 2012, and in 2014, he co-founded Chaincode with Suhas. He has enjoyed contributing to Bitcoin Core and learning about the exciting, nascent field of cryptocurrency ever since. To me, I mean, that sounds really whimsical, like kind of noobish, like, you know, I'm just really enjoying learning about cryptocurrencies and I'm going to start up he's got that's the current bio on an 11-year-old not-for-profit startup. And it sounds like their background is highly entrenched in sort of the legacy financial system. And even, you know, working on it, like you go on to read, I think it's Suhas, very similar background. But, you know, at Hudson River Trading in 2002, where he spent over a decade developing HRT into a global trading firm and helping to shape the complex policy debates surrounding technology and financial markets. In 2014, Suhas co-founded Chaincode Labs with Alex to create a place for engineers and scientists to support the development of decentralized digital currencies and further our collective understanding of how such technologies can work. I think it's not a good situation because they employ quite a lot of core contributors or people who are hired to work on core. And then you're saying that you can have this situation, whether this has happened or not, but it could. Someone could approach them and give direction, like you were saying.
Well, I don't think it's the case. So I've known Alex for a long time. And during the block size wars, we're fighting on the same side. I don't believe that Chaincode as a vehicle is doing anything bad. But I believe there might be some groupthink echo chamber that's being built out internally because they do have a lot of developers that are working, in the same office, thinking the same thing. And that the effect that gives you is really that groupthink. And that is the danger, I would say. There's accusations that someone donated to Chaincode to influence. I don't believe those accusations. And I don't have any doubt on Alex's morality and ethics. But I think it's often blurred because of the behavior of some of the developers they hire. But I believe it would be the same as at Blockstream. There is really a lot of freedom given to the developers and they can basically do what they want. I don't think Alex is saying, push for this change or do something. That's kind of not the way that Chaincode works, nor Blockstream. And that's unfortunate because the developers are behaving in a kind of unprofessional way and they're not really, acting like you would expect a steward of the Bitcoin protocol to act, especially when there's a lot of outcry about what they're doing and the changes they're making. And I would say that has more to do with understanding psychology and EQ than anything else. Like, Bitcoin is money. And I think, well, some people are debating, like, do the developers know that Bitcoin is money? Because they seem to think it's data or data storage. And some developers have said the same thing, like, Bitcoin is the data storage and all data on Bitcoin is the same. But, you know, it's definitely expected that people will get angry if you modify the software that they've been using for a very long time. And a lot of the people working on Bitcoin that are pushing for these changes, or are even maintainers now, are basically new to the space. And there's like Bitcoin plebs and OGs that have been running Bitcoin Core since, you know, 15 years ago, right? Like, I've been running Core since I started in Bitcoin. So I think I'm a Bitcoin user. And it's just kind of frustrating, I think, when you see people changing something, even if it's a default, even if it's a weak counter to spam, which is an argument that's thrown out there. But the crux of it is like, Bitcoin node software is sort of synonymous with Bitcoin. And to change something that belongs to someone else is sort of a no-no, right? In game development, we have to deal with this a lot. It's basically, when you want to nerf something, you have to think very carefully about nerfing it. And you could say removing some of these filters or defaults or standardness rules is the same as nerfing. Even if it's the right thing to do, just psychologically taking something away from somebody will create this, you know, immune reaction from the people running the software. And I don't think that the developers really understood that. Or maybe they do understand it and they just don't care about it. But then that begets the question again of, who are they developing the software for? Is it for very highly technical people, or is it people running the nodes? And then that led to another big wave of gaslighting and like Core developers and Core supporters saying, it doesn't really matter if you run a node, like, which runs counter to Bitcoin itself. So it's just a really messy situation that we're in.
Yeah, for sure. So let's, and you've been, that's why I brought you on, because you've been through the block size wars. You've been there through, maybe that, I hope that was messier than this. So this, or, you know, but I'll ask you maybe, but let's talk about spam. I mean, is there spam on the Bitcoin network to some extent? What is spam?
Well, spam is something you don't want, right? Like, if you make a comparison to email, what is spam email? It's like unsolicited email that just comes to you that you probably don't want, right? And I don't think there's a direct one-to-one comparison for Bitcoin spam to anything else in the world, because there's really nothing else like Bitcoin. So you can't really directly compare it to email spam. Mail spam, physical mail spam, maybe, but it's still like not perfectly a one-to-one example. But I would say, yes, there is spam. And this is a whole other dimension to the whole debate, which is, some Core supporters are saying there's no such thing as spam because the spammers paid a fee. But going back to the imperfect example, the guy that's spamming your email also paid for his internet connection. That doesn't necessarily mean that you want to get that, right? But I believe there's a simpler way to define spam, which is, it is not an organic Bitcoin transaction. It is trying to do something else. Like, if you think about what a Bitcoin transaction is, yes, it is data, but it is Bitcoin's native data, which is Bitcoin. So if you're sending someone Bitcoin, that's not spam, because that's the native data of the network. But a lot of this spam that we're encountering now is like ordinals and other types of things that are kind of trying to put data or images embedded into Bitcoin, because they're trying to piggyback on Bitcoin's immutability. So I think you can sort of make that delineation and say, this is spam, this is not spam, because these are Bitcoin transactions. People using the software to do what, you know, it originally did out of the box. It didn't out of the box let you send ordinals, right? Ordinals is actually a separate protocol completely. It's got its own node software. All it does is point to Bitcoin and say, you know, we think that this is an ordinal, and you can decode it and it looks like a picture,
right?
So maybe talking more about spam. What are the risks of spam, or the risks of allowing spam, or consenting to spam? So like, yeah, what do you see as some of the risks of, is it a storage perspective? You know, would nodes get too big, too hard to run? Is it a what is in the spam perspective? Like, oh, it's not just pictures, but it could be pictures you don't want on your node. What are your take on these issues related to spam? And
yeah, so there, you're outlining, I think, the main talking points from the not side, which is, spam is bad. It'll make it harder if you run the network. You're relaying garbage. It's more bandwidth usage. It's potentially storing data you don't want, like, you know, adult pictures or whatever on your node, and legal liabilities. I think, you know, you could argue some of those points. It's not something I would argue myself, because you can't really stop it. And this is where the debate kind of gets complex, because both sides are talking past each other, where Knots people are saying you can stop spam, and, you know, the filters prevented 99% of spam or whatever, and there's only a small percentage that actually came through because of things like ordinals and whatnot. And then the core side will say, well, yeah, but it still goes through, right? So it's kind of there's an impasse there. And I think the best way to look at it is really through the lens of the civil society and how, you know, traffic works. There was an image I posted a while ago of, third world country traffic and developed country traffic. So in the third world, everyone's trying to run the red light and the intersections are all jammed up and, you know, traffic is backed up for hours. And this is because marginally you can go to where you're going faster if you break the rules, right? If you run the red light and you cut people off. These are not necessarily against the law, especially cutting people off, but they're sort of standardness things. It's just, you know, basic courtesy and being civil. And it's the same thing. If you remove all these rules and you encourage bad behavior, like putting pictures on, then you're going to get more of that. And that's where it degrades. So in civilized society, in Western countries, you follow the rules of the road. You don't clog the intersection. And, you know, that's not necessarily that it's that there's a mechanism that prevents you from cutting people off or running a red light. It's just good behavior. So I think having a lot of these guardrails in place, the limits that are already there, are very important. But another aspect of it is really the core people are saying the fees are the filter. And I think that misses another important point, which is you're not looking at the entire network and what has happened. So it's true that fees do filter spam, because you, Cedric, as a Bitcoin transacting user of the network, you're paying fees to send your transactions, right? And a spammer also pays fees. But what we did during the block size war is we changed that whole dynamic. We changed the unit economics because we increased the block size and decreased fee pressure. So we kind of made it cheaper to spam the network too. And what's interesting for me is that only one person had talked about decreasing the block size back then, and that was Luke. And I think he was right. So it begs the question of, did we actually win the block size war, or did we lose? Because we did have a net increase in the effective block space going to 4 megabytes. And the repercussions of that, I don't think we've really analyzed or reasoned out. But I think maybe it was a mistake to go to 4. Maybe we should have kept it at 1 and left the settings of the network as they were. But I think at the time, everyone was thinking, well, we need to increase the block size and drop fees. But there are a lot of unintended consequences when you change the network default. So, you know, Bitcoin price crashed in 2017 or whatever it was. And a lot of miners went out of business, right? Because they were no longer profitable. And changing the unit economics of Bitcoin block size is definitely a factor in that, right? If there was more fee pressure, maybe it would have made a marginal difference and smaller miners would have won. But, you know, one of the arguments to remove OpReturn, or like remove the limits on OpReturn, is because core developers wanted to stop private mempools. So people sending transactions directly to miners. And the reasoning for that is to mitigate mining centralization. But actually increasing the block size and making it harder for smaller miners to survive when prices are low probably harmed mining decentralization a lot more.
What about the notion of censorship? If Core would say, you know, or the stewards of Core would say, hey, you know, we think you're trying to censor what's happening here, what can happen here, and that's a slippery slope. That the filters are censorship, and if we say what can and can't come in, we're on that slope. I think that's kind of been an argument made by Core and the supporters of going to Core v30.
Yeah, but I mean, you can't really censor transactions. The standardness rules or filters, they are sort of a deterrent, first of all, and sort of a declaration of what the developers and users of the network view the purpose of the network is for. So it's sort of rejecting the spam transactions and saying, this is not for Bitcoin. And that's actually why Ethereum was created, because Vitalik felt hostility from Bitcoin developers about, you know, doing a lot of things that he wanted to do on Ethereum. So he went and made Ethereum. Obviously, he went and made it for personal gain as well. But, you know, that there was a discussion or a back and forth about that topic where he said, you know, we don't feel welcome to build on this. And I think that's a valid point. If you suddenly remove all these rules and you open the door to spam, then you're kind of saying like Bitcoin is for storing pictures and ordinals and all this stuff. And, you know, that's a problem. It's not really that you can censor that, but, you know, you can encourage more of it by removing the barriers for them to enter the space and to build on Bitcoin.
Would you see, let's say that V30 is not issued or shipped and more people use Knot and use the filters. Are filters effective?
Well, they're not 100% effective, right? And I think a lot of people have pointed that out. And it's like more of a policy thing. It's like, we don't welcome spam. And you can still spam, right? You can still get your transactions into a block. So it's not censorship. But I think the discussion breaks down because, you know, people like to say your filters don't work. And I don't know exactly what the Knot's camp is saying, but it feels like there some of them are saying they absolutely do work, but you know, you can bypass filters, but I definitely think they signal something, and removing that signal is dangerous. If especially you couple that with small changes that pave the way for more and more spam. So I think, you know, Mechanic and other guys, you know, I don't agree with everything they say, but signaling this change in what Bitcoin Core developers are doing is definitely worth bringing up and bringing to attention that we're all talking about it and we're now concerned about what Bitcoin Core developers are doing with Bitcoin Core, especially given what they themselves have been saying and their attitude towards Bitcoin users too. Like, you know, they're saying we shouldn't listen to any of these guys because they're not smart enough to do anything and we need to do things our own way. So it's sort of emblematic of a bigger problem. It's not really about spam. It's not really about filters. It's really about, you know, what are the different implementations building? Like, what is Bitcoin Core building? What is your end goal? And I think it's a difficult question to ask because Bitcoin Core has always tried to maintain, like, there's no leader. There is no roadmap. It's just a lot of people working on different things. But all these different things eventually get filtered, pun intended or not intended, into a release. So somebody is saying what makes it through. And all of these little changes have large effects if you add them up all together. So you start removing things like op return limits, you know, it opens the door to potentially more spam, especially given that it doesn't really do anything because, you know, op returns are more expensive. Again, people will pollute the UTXO set. But then you look at more and more things that are slowly being added. Like, I think they're lowering the dust relay fee, right, to 0.1 sats, because the argument is, well, you can also you know, go below 1 sat per V-byte. So therefore, we should remove that. And I think that's merged into 30. But, you know, that's another limit, too, that it's not part of consensus rules. It's more of a standardness thing or a policy thing. But what if they also lower the dust limit to 0.1 sats per vbyte, right? Then you're encouraging smaller UTXOs and you've made it cheaper. So all of these things compound, and it's kind of unbelievable that they're not seeing this. And I think this is where you kind of get into the whole rabbit hole of conspiracy. Like, how can they not see all these things compounding? So they must see it, and therefore there's some level of compromise, or, you know, they're being bribed or something. So it's a really difficult position, I think, that everyone's being put into.
So where are we in this process with Core B30? When is that set to be released, and what do you put the odds of it getting released at?
Well, it's definitely going to be a release, right? They just released 29.1, but, you know, it doesn't seem like the core developers are going to accommodate what the users want. They're going to just move ahead with what they want to do, which is within their right. And I think it's also within the right of people to run Knots or another implementation too. It is a free market. It's just disappointing that they're seeking not to consider what the users are doing. But, you know, I don't know when it's going to be released, but it'll come. And I think a lot of people will just not run it because of all these concerns with...
Is that the third path where people stay on 28 or 29.1 and never go to 30 and don't do an alternative client as well? And that's a bit of ossification?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I don't think I will upgrade. I'll stick on 29 because I don't see any need yet. But I don't think you can not upgrade forever, because Bitcoin is software, and software needs to be patched for security reasons and updated. So there is talk about having a third implementation. I think there's sort of another faction that's not Core, not Knots, that wants to build a new client that is more battle-tested, more secure, leading towards ossification or building more consensus before changes that are implemented. And I think that's probably going to happen because it is needed. Like, you can stick on 29 for a year or two, but you cannot stick on 29 for 5-10 years. Someone's got to stand up and do something and bring in security fixes from Core or from Knots or whatever. But someone has to do that.
I mean, if you look at this from sort of a corporate perspective, which Core is not, Bitcoin's not a company, but if you think about like the near monopoly market share they had, then in a short period of time, let's say they lost 10 to 16% to Knots alone. I mean, wouldn't people at the company be apocalyptic?
Well, I have a personal opinion. I think, I think they should definitely be worried. And I think a lot of people that were behaving in a certain way should probably step down as a maintainer for how they're behaving. Because, you know, you're not acting as a steward of the network. That's how Adam Back phrased it. Like, core developers, I think, especially maintainers, are stewards of the network. And you cannot be a good steward if you just say, like, we're going to make this change for this reason. And the reason is not even necessarily a good one. I think that's why people are up in arms, because they see the reasoning behind it as bad. But yeah, I mean, it is a massive shock that Knots has this much adoption. And I often see it being countered that a lot of the Knots nodes are fake, and these are all fake. And it's just like a Sybil attack. But I've seen people on X that are posting that they're running Knots. And I know who they are. They're NIMs, but they're like serious OG people with a lot of Bitcoin. And you can't really discard the fact that people are running Knots at this point, because you can't know which is a fake node and what is a real node. You have to kind of factor in that there is a significant amount of people on Knots now. And that's got to be part of the calculus for how Bitcoin moves forward. So going back to what you said, does this mean ossification? Very well could be. Like, this could be the point at which Bitcoin ossifies. And it was just because of some hubris from some developers and maintainers that we don't want to listen to the users. Because now, to get any change across the line, like covenants or whatnot, you're going to have to go to Knots as well and have them agree. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. Having the network split into, I would say, three implementations is a good thing. I posted about this before, but you know, one implementation is monopoly. It's just they'll be able to ram through any change that they can decide on themselves internally and force that on the network. And yes, people cannot upgrade, but to a point. If you have two implementations, it's war. And I posted that before things got really heated, but that's exactly what happened. You have Knots versus Core now. And I think a really important thing to consider here is Knots is new. And a lot of the people that are just blindly supporting Core, they're acting as if Knots has existed for like 5 years or 10 years. This faction, quote unquote, only existed because a lot of the Core people said, you know, go run something else. So that's exactly what they did, right? As a user, if you're being told the software is not for you, you're getting changes that you don't want, then you need to look for an alternative, right? It's like nobody has that nobody's so timid and ashamed that they will just like tuck tail and obey, right? That's not your Bitcoiner. So Knots is a new phenomenon. And I think it's definitely got a lot of traction, but only two major implementations leads to war. And it's getting pretty bad, like the insults that are thrown back and forth now. So I think three would balance it, like three major implementations, each one with 33-ish% of the network or 30% of the network would be the most healthy thing for Bitcoin in the long run.
Yeah, I can only imagine how it's got to be really confusing, because I think a lot of people who may be approaching the idea of running nodes, maybe haven't been running nodes, or kind of like they would look at Core and regardless of his argument say, well, that's where the most eyeballs are, the most validation, the most trust. And I think back to 2017, and I came in late 2017 when I really started to look at Bitcoin as an asset, and it was confusing. You know, it was a different story then, but you had sort of Ethereum and Litecoin and altcoins, and you're trying to figure that out, and the ICO craze, and you're trying to figure out, is blockchain the secret sauce, or just, you know, or is it really for the money and separating money and state? And then you have Bcash, right? And it's confusing. You're like, what the fuck is a block size? You know, I'm just trying to figure out cryptography now and game theory. And then you say to yourself, just gut check, you're like, well, maybe the renegade, you know, there's a party that came to Bitcoin as being a little bit of a renegade, let's say, or contrarian, or, you know, thinking outside the box. And then you're like, well, I'm here and now you got this war in Bitcoin. Maybe the smaller group are the renegades within the renegades, you know, and you just don't know where that could be very confusing, I think. Do you think that what we're going through now is sort of the beginning of what could be another civil war or block size war 2.0? Or is this sort of like, however this gets sorted out, it's not that bad yet, and we'll kick the can down the road, and people will run V30, people will run Knots, and there'll be a third client, and it'll sort itself out.
Yeah, well, I hope it doesn't turn into a block size war type thing. And it's a bit different this time. It's more like there are parts of both sides that are correct, right? Core is saying, remove all these things because they're just guardrails and they don't really do anything and they can be bypassed. And it's true. You can bypass it, but you know, you have to bypass it. And then the Knot side is saying, you know, we want our filters, we want our controls, and we want you not to change these things. And they're also right. So it's not really that we're arguing over consensus rules. It's more about policy and standardness. And you know, I've seen a lot of Core people say, well, Knots guys, go fork off and make your own coin. And nobody really wants that, right? Going back to what I said earlier, the Knots people were Bitcoin users, Bitcoin Core users, right? They're not people trying to change Bitcoin and, you know, change the rules fundamentally. It's like they don't want things changed. And that is a valid thing. That's a valid position that Bitcoin Core developers should not change these rules. And I don't think there's a good reason for them to change it as well, especially in the way that they're proposing. So Adam Back has also said they should have just made it 160 bytes. If you wanted to accommodate Citrea, just give them 160, right? That's enough, not going up to 10,000, right? And I think that would have been a reasonable thing. And if that was what they did originally, this whole thing would not have happened. But developers, you know, they think like a developer, which is a lot of black and white thinking and trying to future-proof. So they're saying, well, let's just remove it because it can be bypassed and we don't want to have to adjust it later. But I would disagree on Adam on that point. I don't think they should have been accommodating to Citrea because, again, the slippery slope. And there are many layer twos that don't need any change, Liquid being one of them, right? Liquid doesn't use op returns to do anything. So it's zero. And then you have RGB, which is just hit mainnet now. I think I talked to Maxim. He said they use 32 bytes of op return. So there's really no reason that Citrea has to use 160. It's just they designed it in such a way that they want to use that. And you can change it for them, but then who are you going to change it for next, right? And I don't think you should do that. It's that slippery slope. But you know, you don't need to do these changes. I don't think that's a valid reason that because a standardness rule can be bypassed, you should just let that rule be bypassed because you're signaling that anything can be done with Bitcoin now and everything is game, which can crowd out real transactions. Like if you go back to the example of allowing for smaller UTXOs, if Core changes defaults like the dust limit and the relay limit, then you might balloon up the UTXO set because it's now cheaper, even easier to make these small UTXOs. And then the argument would be, I've seen it, is like, yeah, well, then pay more for transactions. But you have to consider also perverse external incentives. So what if, a mining pool like Mara is now invested in like some protocol that is creating all these little tiny UETXOs? They may not make the rational economic choice to mine your transaction, a Bitcoin transaction, and make more fees because, well, guess what? They are making money off of this new protocol that is creating lots and lots of tiny UTXOs, and they're listed on a public market, and they own 60% of the shares in that company, right? You have to consider all of these things, and you have to at some point say, that's not something we want, right? Like, just because something is a consensus valid transaction does not mean that all the standardness rules don't matter at all. I'll give you another example. Like, you could have a mining pool that just mines empty blocks. Empty blocks are consensus valid, right? That's a valid Bitcoin block, an empty block. And pools do that sometimes. They'll mine empty blocks and mine on top of them because that gives them an advantage, right? And you combine that with another perverse external incentive, which is someone made some other protocol called proof of empty blocks. And now nobody is mining full blocks because they're extracting value, MEV or whatever you want to call it, by minting coins on this new network that are proof of empty blocks. So at that point, what do? You say, okay, well, it's valid. There's nothing to do about it. We just, that's it. Bitcoin's dead now, right? Or do you say, like, these guys are attacking the network? Just like a lot of the Knot people are saying, the spammers are attacking the network. There has to be some level of common sense where you say something is bad for the network. And ironically, Bitcoin Core is also saying that because they're saying private mempools are bad for the network. It contributes to centralization. But there's a logical fallacy there, which is private mempools are valid under consensus rules, just like proof of empty blocks, right? So at some point, you have to say some things are bad for Bitcoin and they should not be tolerated or at the very least discouraged.
Yeah, this is incredible. What do you just say about the culture, or what kind of, like, about Bitcoin, this discourse, Is it mature? Yeah. What is your take on the culture of Bitcoin right now?
That's a tricky one. So, you know, I don't subscribe to a lot of the conspiracy theories about motivations of Bitcoin developers, but I think there's something more basic than that, which is, you know, what are they actually trying to do? Are they trying to get glory from implementing some feature and getting something merged to, you know, cement their names in the halls of fame of Bitcoin development? I think that is actually more likely, that somebody wants to add something to Bitcoin or change something and get fame, right? It's not necessarily that someone bribed them or they're paid to do something. It could just be simple as wanting fame or lining up their next job or something like that, right? And I think these things have to be taken into consideration. Like, we should really follow the credo of don't trust, verify. Not just, you know, we should trust these guys and we should believe everything they say and not question it, especially when it feels like it can be wrong. But the culture, I would say, of development is, I think it's kind of an echo chamber. Like, if you look at Anton's recent post, he was saying something like, you know, I took the opposite position about filters, and, you know, Greg Maxwell said, you know, it doesn't work, so therefore I'm right. But, you know, Greg Maxwell is just one opinion. You can't have that appeal to authority there, right? You have to look at the situation and the item under discussion and debate that on its own merits. Not that, you know, Greg Maxwell said so, but that is kind of the culture that a lot of development has devolved into. And maybe it's normal because a lot of people at these companies, they don't want to risk their job. I don't know. Or they don't want to do anything that may cut their funding. Like, I think the worthwhile thing, if your goal is to fight mining centralization, to have some more controversial takes or projects like decreasing block size, that can be done with a soft fork. But pushing for that, building consensus, you know, that's not in fashion. Whereas if you're saying, you know, we want to tweak some of these defaults and variables, then, you know, that's okay. It's like an okay topic to discuss and get funding for. Whereas if you are pushing for block size decreases, then you might get branded like Luke and a radical or a crazy guy.
Right, right. What are maybe some of the lessons learned from your time in Bitcoin, or particularly the block size wars? Like, what would be sort of an optimal way for this to play out? Or how would you, like, should it be over dinners between important players? You know, should it be podcasts? Should it be at conferences? You know, should it be on Twitter or at X? Like, how should this kind of discourse go in a more optimal manner?
Well, I think the most optimal thing is really at this point that we more or less ossify outside of agreed security threats and issues that are, you know, no-brainers. Like, yeah, we should probably work towards some level of quantum resistance, right? We should fix bugs that are known issues and security holes. But I think the more important thing is just really adopting that don't trust, verify ethos and questioning the motivations. And maybe funding some more research on, you know, what we've done and were those the right things to do? Because I think blind trust in developers is a huge risk, because developers are fallible, right? There are things that we've done and changed in Bitcoin that I don't think we've fully analyzed the impacts of, right? Like, you know, Taproot and being able to inscribe data. That's like a recent side effect of things that were done years ago. Or increasing the block weight from SegWit. That's also something that probably had a lot of impacts, right? And now we just keep moving forward and we want new things. Like, there's a push for covenants. And I think Jimmy Song had a good take on it. He posted a video basically saying, we don't really know what the impacts are, right? There's like a bounty, and if you can, you know, abuse a covenant somehow and steal money, you'll win the bounty. But it's not really about that. It's like, what are the knock-on side effects? What are the longer-term implementations of changing the protocol in a fundamental manner? I think the best thing to do at this point is really to take a step back and evaluate a lot of the things that have been done and what the implementations of those things were. Because if you just trust the developers, then that's like saying trust the science, right? It's like a major, major risk. And the culture is that we don't question the developers. Like, I think in 2022 or something, I posted about CVE 2018-17-144, which was an inflation bug, which I'm not going to name names, but a developer added that. And I got a lot of blowback because people were saying, well, it was everyone's fault. It was missed in testing and I'm responsible. But the real point is, like, one guy thought he was making Bitcoin better and changed something, which added this inflation bug that, you know, was out there in Bitcoin. Fortunately, it wasn't abused, but we have to question and look at the system more holistically and slow down on trying to change Bitcoin, because it's a $2 trillion asset now. And if we're not really careful, if we're not looking at all aspects, all impacts, you know, that can be catastrophic. Even fixing a bug, like, what are the trade-offs? What are the real costs of fixing a bug? So remember, in the block size wars, it was to fix malleability. That's what one of the reasons for SegWit, fixing transaction malleability. And the developer said, we need that for Lightning. But, you know, there are ways around transaction malleability. It's just not the optimal way at which they would have wanted to implement it. If you wait for one confirmation and, you know, the transaction is confirmed, then an attacker can't malleate that transaction anymore. Lightning will work a little bit differently, but Lightning definitely doesn't work in the exact way that the developers of the protocol envisioned, right? The majority of people using Lightning today are using custodial Lightning wallets run by, you know, big companies and service providers that are always online. So you have to look back and say, did we need that fix? With the way that usage of the network today is, it seems to me like it would have been fine because, you know, it's LSPs and custodial wallets, and they would have dealt with the malleability on their side, not the end user. But people developing the software are sort of developing it for themselves, and they're highly technical, right? You know, they can, you know, do everything through command line. Most average plebs and Bitcoiners don't. And this is why you have nodes in a box, right? And I think, you know, a lot of their perspective comes from the consideration only of themselves and someone highly technical running this stuff, right? Like, they might say, yeah, you can change a default easily through command lines. But for your average pleb, that's not something that they can do, nor do they want to do it. And that's why nodes in a box exist. And you kind of can't dismiss that entire segment of Bitcoin users or call them fake or irrelevant or whatever. They are Bitcoin users as well. So I think overall, the entire culture has to change in terms of Bitcoin development to be more cautious, to think more adversarially, to think from multiple angles, not simply from the code, which is binary, yes or no, but from how users use the network, how other external parties use the network, and how they could potentially misuse that, and just taking into account that people are not that technical and, you know, they want a client where they can configure things easily.
Wow. All right. I'm going to, so my last real thought on this, and I'll defer to you for how much more we could put into this, but I think that, you know, for the average pleb, this could be a little bit scary. And I'll put myself in that bucket. Like, I'm not exactly sure what's going on. I'm trying to don't trust verify, and this is a little confusing. And I've seen even people on X say, hey, you know, I'm an average pleb and I'm a little worried about my life savings here. You know, I have my life savings in Bitcoin, or a lot of it, you know. And then I wonder whether, you know, I would think that at some point, or that this Bitcoin's under attack. It's meant to be under attack. It's anti-fragile. needs to demonstrate its anti-fragility. But so there's attacks that's happened, that are happening, and are going to happen. And I think a nation state or nation states would attack it. And for that, in my mind, though, it's not about price. It's not about like destroying its store value case. It's trying to make it a pet rock or sort of like digital gold. And just not have it really used in circular economies and for censorship resistance and censorship resistance and privacy and sort of self-custody. And I just don't know how that attack is going to come, whether it's trying to force us into ossification and you're not improving the software, as you're saying, or is it going to come from what we're seeing now? You know, you just always wonder. And so my question to you then is, while this is all happening, and hopefully we put in the work, Bitcoin is software, humans write it and guide it, and we figure this out. But in sort of the, you know, does this affect your sort of bullishness or on price? You know, and this is not financial advice, but like, are these separate issues, you know, or is this sort of like, you know, oh, wow, like, you know what I mean? Does this affect sort of Bitcoin's price cycles or how people feel about it as sort of an asset in that sense?
Not really. So I guess a lot of people seeing this, they're probably on X a lot and they're seeing like what looks like a war, but I don't think it's the end of the world, especially because, you know, people have sounded the alarm and now there's more scrutiny to what Bitcoin developers are doing. If you go back like a year or two, you know, no one was really watching it carefully, right? But now people are watching it. And I think having Knots gain traction, more developers working on it, more funding for it is definitely a good thing. So again, like having multiple major implementations that are used by, you know, economic actors, economic nodes is definitely strengthening the network. And you know, there will be spam. Like we can't avoid it, we can't prevent it, but we can deter it and discourage it. And I think that should mitigate a lot of these attacks. But I think the biggest thing is that now we're kind of aware of what's going on. I don't know if it's intentional or unintentional, but we know that things are being changed in Bitcoin that are weakening its resistance to spam. And we're doing something about it. Like a lot of people are. So I don't think the network's at risk. And even if it is spammed, we just have to fight back. Like it's always going to be a cat and mouse game. So if you have external, perverse external incentives at play, well, nothing a node software developer does is going to fix that. It's going to be up to the people running the nodes and building businesses, building on top of Bitcoin and using Bitcoin that are going to do something, right? If you look at the block size war, you know, a lot of the developers didn't really participate in it. Very few of the core developers did. You know, it was a few developers, Luke included, you know, maybe Eric Lombroso and a couple others. But for the most part, it was like, you know, Bitcoiners. Maybe like Giacomo, Francis Pouliot, like kind of like more cypherpunk people that are out in the world doing things and, you know, engaging. A lot of the other developers were kind of not supportive. Like if you look at who supported UASF, like not that many.
Wow. Thank you. I really appreciate you jumping on this call. This has been really helpful. You know, so I'll leave it to you for any parting words and let people know where they can find you and your work. I want to have you back as soon as possible to get into the whole show I was prepping for without this whole topic, you know, so we can get into Jan 3 and Aqua and everything and nation state adoption. So I'll leave it to you for any parting words and let people know where they can find you and your work.
Sure. I'm on X. My handle is Excelion, and then Jan 3 is at Jan3.com. We build the Aqua wallet and you can find Aqua at Bitcoin, at Aqua Bitcoin. So that's basically it. But parting words is really just, you know, don't trust Verify. Run a node. One of the great side effects of this whole debacle is that more Bitcoiners are running nodes now, right? And, you know, that is definitely a good thing that they are running their own nodes, verifying their own transactions and actively following what's going on. Like what the danger is that people are oblivious to changes that are happening and things being pushed in the wrong direction. The only way to counter that is to be aware and prepare.
Yeah. So there's levels to monetary sovereignty. If you want to be a first class monetary sovereign citizen, run a node, self-custody your Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Thanks, Edric.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Bitcoin Matrix. If you enjoyed the conversation, don't forget to like, subscribe, and drop a comment below with any questions or thoughts you may have. We'd love to hear from you. You can support the show by checking out our sponsors and affiliate links in the description. It helps keep bringing you great content while connecting you with awesome products that I believe in. Share this episode with your friends, family, or anyone curious about Bitcoin. And let's keep growing this community together. Stay curious, keep stacking, and I'll catch you in the next one.